This is The Conversation. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com. It's the S.S. Cole cold case episode coming up. And let me just say right off the bat, if you don't give a flying about painting, Cole is a Los Angeles-based painter, you should still stick around because it's a great story, great to listen to, very entertaining, anecdotes, challenges, the obligatory, awkward, and intense studio visits. It's all here, so there's no reason for you to leave. Also, joining me for the first time is co-host Deb Cloudman, Los Angeles-based dealer Deb Cloudman, that is, who is thoroughly up to the task, as you will soon hear. So it's a great episode. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're going to stick around. Also, please stick around for the surprise bit after the episode concludes. Before we get there, let me tell you that our affiliate partner today is Made with Color at madewithcolor.com. Made with Color is a website building platform designed specifically to meet the needs of artists, designers, and other creative types, particularly those who are maybe less than naturally inclined to build their own websites. Very easy to use, great customer service. And if you sign up today by entering in the promo code CONVERSATION, all lowercase, you will receive 29% off your first year of service. That's Made with Color at madewithcolor.com. Let's get to that conversation with the S.S. Cole case. Thank you very much for being here. And remember to stay tuned for just after the episode concludes. I will talk to you later. This is The Conversation. I'm Michael Shaw, and I'm joined by a couple of newcomers. Co-host for tonight. I'm joined by co-host Deb Cloudman. Hello, Deb.
Hey, Michael.
Dealer, Los Angeles-based dealer, for those who are not familiar.
Dealer.
And Gallaged. Los Angeles-based, our guest is Los Angeles-based artist, Cole Case.
Hello.
Hey, Cole. A very alliterative name. So what was your parents thinking going with the Cole for the case?
My father was in the Navy, and he had a friend named Bob Cole. And Bob was just too generic, and he also liked jazz music a lot. And Cozy Cole was one of his favorite guys. He just thought Cole was an interesting name and different. It wasn't just like, you know, Bob or Jerry or Michael or Deb or sorry. But it was an unusual name, and it was, and I joke around now because it was difficult as a child because it was weird and people thought it was, ooh, what a, you know, weird name. And there was a certain point in life where it was great because it was unique and short and, as you said, alliterative and quick and easy for people to remember. But unfortunately, once the interwebs and the Wi-Fis took over, it's now a huge problem because if you Google me, what comes up most of the time is not me, but the USS Cole case, the bombing of the USS Cole by Al-Qaeda. So all this stuff comes up about Osama bin Laden and terrorism. Yeah. Kenneth Cole briefcases, a really unflattering photograph of me from Google that I can't get rid of, or Cold Case, the television show. So all these other things come up now. So what was a really great name in the 80s, it was like really sweet, has now become a real detriment like in the 21st century.
So was it a name immune from being made fun of by your peers?
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah, it was totally just... Oh,
are there names that are immune from being made fun of by your peers?
No, not at all.
I think the most generic names tend to be.
So we did okay.
But it was easy because it was...
I wasn't, certainly. Were you?
Yeah.
What, not
were you
teased?
Immune?
I was never immune. No. But character, man. Gotta have the teasing.
Yeah, totally. It's good for you.
Yeah.
Right. Build strong bodies 12 ways, as the thing said. Anyways, but that's where it came from. But it is now, it's literally like, I have to call myself Cole L. Case in my any correspondence or identification because Cole Case, there's somebody else out there or something else like it. So it's unfortunately, who could have foreseen, but in the 21st century, it's a pain in the ass.
Maybe this is the beginning of some kind of amazing painting project in which you, you know, utilize different identities.
Possibly.
You're like, no, not
No, I'm going, actually, I'm going back to that. A lot of what I'm doing now is going back to that, you know, six-year-old guy that draws bugs and spaceships and stuff is what I'm doing.
Yeah, well, speaking of Speak of the Devil, you have a fascination with identified and unidentified flying objects? Or?
Yeah, with mostly identified. I have friends who are more fascinated with the unidentified. But but I grew up, again, due to my age, I grew up in the middle of the, you know, the race to the moon, the Apollo program. In the 1960s, which when you were a kid then was like, you know, it was huge, you know, and I wanted to be an astronaut, you know, like a million other American youth. And a great story about that was, all these years later, I'm a huge Kubrick fan also, and my parents, we went to go see 2001: A Space Odyssey on July 20th, 1969, which was the day we walked on the moon. And we went to
your parents took you.
They said, "Yeah, because this is again before the internet.
That's
we didn't know when it was. We knew we were on the moon. We didn't know when it was going to happen.
Right.
My parents thought it would be cool, and I really wanted to see this movie because it's like all.
And you were
space.
What? Not eight, nine at the time.
1969. So I'm 8 years old.
Okay.
And we go see the movie, and it's like
that's pretty young for any generation to go see that movie.
Yeah, and I was into it, man. I loved the monkeys, you know, and the spaceships.
And you didn't fall asleep.
No. What happened was they. Turned off the movie and they sent us home. This would never happen now. The guy turned the lights up in the middle of the movie and said, "We're going to walk on the moon in like 20 minutes. Everybody get out of here, go home and turn on your TVs and watch it."
Wow.
Oh, that's so nice.
And so I've been watching Stanley Kubrick's vision in 70 millimeter Cinerama
right.
of the moon and all this stuff. And I go home. And we're watching on this little TV, and it's black and white, and the image was upside down for a while before they figured it out. And I was like, Mom, like, when are we going to go back? I want to see the moon. I don't want to see the moon. I want to see Stanley Kubrick's moon.
Right.
So, which was a funny moment because I felt gypped that, you know, the real moon was so much less beautiful than the actual moon. And was actually, I would have preferred to go back. Analysts would have a field day with that, but I'd rather
but,
go...
Well, speaking of analysis, I mean, the fact that those two things coincided cemented that you would be painting spacecraft for the rest of your life,
or drawing them, you know, which I was obsessed with as a kid, and other things that are traditional kid things that you draw, like race cars and bugs, and which I was fascinated with.
Right.
And those were the things that got me into... drawing and painting when I was really young, and my parents really encouraged that and hired tutors and things to help me learn.
When did they hire tutors? So did it start with you just kind of like, you know, taking the notebook and going out?
I remember the first drawing I made where it was obvious that it's like, oh, like this is, children don't, like I drew a plane. I went to the airport. I love to go to the airport and watch planes take off. Mm. Yeah. Back then, and I went home and
I drew.
You're
a little boy.
Yeah, I'm a little boy, and I drew a plane, like with the landing gear and the numbers and the wind. I mean, it was like really detailed, and it was one of those things where, like, my parents were like, "Oh, like this, like other kids don't do this. Like he's like kids don't draw that well." And so they there were some people that they knew when we lived in Sacramento. Like, there was a nice lady that lived down the street that helped teach me how to draw, like, insects and things because I was fascinated by, you know, hornets and bees and things like that. And so they were always really encouraging from an early age, like, to, you know, encourage me to do that.
So Sacramento was...
1967 to 1972.
And you were born...
San Francisco in 1961.
San Francisco.
Yeah, all
so
California.
Started,
yeah, we moved
but
around
started up north for the most
Yeah, my childhood was all in northern central California. My parents are from the valley.
Yeah.
That valley.
Right.
The San Joaquin Valley. My dad's from Modesto, my mom's from Stockton. And then we moved down here in 72, and we've been down here ever since. So
let me fast forward for a second, because I'm curious to reconcile this hardcore drive towards, you know, drawing and painting, and then you end up going to Stanford.
Right.
Was that a liberal arts education with an art major?
No, I actually ended up being an English major.
So wait, okay. So yeah. so how do you explain that then? After all that art interest?
I was really interested in the art. I was a cartoon. If you wanted to categorize me through high school, I was a cartoonist. And I was lucky enough to. I was at Beverly Hills High School, and they, you know, as you can imagine, they had a really great journalism program with a weekly newspaper that was very as professionally done as a high school paper could be. And we routinely, you know, not just myself but other people on the staff routinely won statewide, you know, journalism competitions. I was the state champion political cartoonist my junior and senior years. Another one of the people who was the champions.
Were you doing?
They were political.
Yeah, so you were sort of a caricaturist, or were you a political cartoonist?
Yeah, a caricaturist. They were always trying to encourage me to write about school issues, which frankly were kind of boring, and I had larger ambitions.
Right.
So I'm always trying to put Richard Nixon in the cartoons and stuff. You know, and the teacher's like, dude, like, what are you, you know, like, this is high school. Like, you don't work for the Washington Post. But it was during Watergate, you know, so I was, you know, lit up by Woodward and Bernstein and all the political cartoons.
And Nixon must have been so fun to draw.
Oh,
too.
Piece of cake. I was good at him. I did a good Carter. I did a good Ford. Like all those.
So the other thing that it makes me wonder is, while you're doing, you know, this cartooning and you're in high school, are you aware of, you know, art classes?
Oh yeah,
and whatnot.
Oh yeah, no.
And people making art. I mean, it was a little early for people to be making art in high school.
Right? I was aware of it, but I really was focused more on cartooning. Like I wanted to be Gary Trudeau. I wanted to be Doonesbury. Like I didn't want to do the straight single frame political cartoon. I wanted to do a strip.
Sure.
Like Charles Schultz, Gary Trudeau, those kinds of guys. And I had a whole portfolio together that I did my freshman year, and I sent it off to all the King Feature Syndicate, United Feature Syndicate. And, of course, it was rejected. You know, I was 17 years old.
Right.
You know, but I was just like, oh, well, they don't want that, you know, to hell with them, you know, kind of thing. And I was frankly filled with that. Gone away to college, 18-year-old. This is exactly what everyone expects me to do. They expect, I felt like at that very early age, I was pigeonholed. I'm the cartoonist. It's like, I'll show them. I'm going to be in a rock band and be an English major. So it was kind of a weird rebellion.
Well, were you showing the people that the syndicates that were rejecting you, or were you who were you showing? I'm trying to figure
everybody,
that out.
Everybody, authority, like, you know, everybody, like everyone from my high school that thought I was going to go do this. It's like, I'll show you that I can do. I'm a renaissance
man. Oh, so in other words, one of your high school reputations was sort of cartoonist nerd, or
That was it. That was not one of them. That was it. That was a cartoonist nerd, you know? And which actually wasn't a bad thing. It was, you know, it was a strange example that you like. It taught me power of the visual image, and it was of course, as a teenager, you want people to like you and you want people to laugh at your jokes, kind of thing. But it also made me realize at a relatively young age how powerful that was, and you could hurt people very badly. And like that, all of a sudden, it wasn't just like making jokes, ha ha. That like a political cartoonist, like you had, like there was a power to the visual arts. In my case, I'm just thinking cartooning. But as we know, in general, there's a power to the image that is really surprising sometimes.
Well, and it sets you up also as being a commentator and observer on sort of the culture that you're a part of, which makes for a really interesting dynamic.
Yeah, and that you and you also have to realize that you're responsible for that. You know, that you're responsible for what you put out there, and the reaction that you get from people is not that there's something wrong with them. It's like you pressed a button or, you know, did something. And hopefully you made them laugh or made them see things differently, but you can really anger people, you know, through that too. So that was an interesting
experience. Did you anger any enemies at school?
Oh, yeah, you know, like social groups or, you know, like, you know, football players or stuff like that. Like people you in high school you don't want to fuck with, you know, like I was like, oh, like don't make the people angry who could hurt you, kind of thing.
But you did.
Absolutely.
And what happened?
And I throttled back. I self-censored. I definitely self-censored. I was like, you know what? I'm going to graduate. I don't need this grief. You know?
Yeah.
Well, I'll be honest. I did. I was. It scared me. Right. The power scared me that I could arouse anger, hostility, and hurt people. You know, hurt their, like, worse than making them angry, but like hurting people. You know, was something that I never thought that I was capable of doing, and realized that it wasn't even necessarily intentional, that it was something that could happen by accident. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't mean to do that, but someone interprets it that way. And that, again, that, you know, the power of the pen sounds corny, but it's really, you know, like, you better think about what you're doing. And I think that that's something I've carried with me to this very day. It's like when I'm working on a painting, it's like, like, what are people taking away from this? Like, you have to take responsibility for it. You can't say, well, I put that monster in there, and so right. people think this about it, and they're stupid for not understanding the context.
Well, that's interesting to me also in relation to, in my perception of your work, you don't have people present in the image for the most part. Is that...
That's changing.
It's changing. It's changing.
Well, yeah, we should say that... yeah. And we're not going to talk about your work,
yeah.
by the way.
No, no.
But... But you do have these crying women in these recent paintings that you sent us.
That's true.
And I can't help but think there's some connection back to the high school era
women.
And what was going on. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah.
I mean, the characters, I'll try not to get too much about the paintings, but
right.
But no, but that's
quotes.
Yeah, but the yeah visual. I'm bending my
can you hear his fingers?
So the women that are coming into it are a weird. They're a mix both of distant past, recent past, and to a certain degree, just present. Not so much a person in the present, but just feelings in the present. And their distant past is, they're usually based on, or at least now they have been based on Manet models. Victorine Meurent, who was the model for Olympia, Gare Saint-Lazare, and the Déjeuner, and Suzon, who is the model for the bar at the Folies Bergère, which is probably my favorite painting in the whole world. And so, then I transform them somehow. So it's like, I put Suzon in Victorine's place, or I swap out the head and I make it, you know, like... high school girlfriend, or I make it I make them look like anime characters.
Who was your high school girlfriend?
She was my very first girlfriend.
Right.
And she probably won't listen to this either. But she and we.
We don't have to worry about that.
Yeah. No, and it was one of the it was my first love relationship, and it was only about it lasted literally from June of 78 until like November. It didn't even last 6 months.
May to December romance.
Which is, huh? Yeah. It was
a May. Well, that's a different kind of May to December. but we were in. It was like I can never go to Venice like ever again, because like that's where it really happened. Was like it's like a cliche. It was like on the back of a gondola at night in the canals, making out with a guy in front of us singing opera on another gondola. I mean, it was that
Venice,
kind of...
Venice, Italy?
Yeah, not Venice, California. Venice,
in
Italy.
High school?
Yeah, this was a post-graduation trip to Europe. And it was that... and to push the Italian connection more, it was that... It's that Romeo and Juliet love, like, mm-hmm. I'll die without you love, like, first love, and I don't think I'll ever experience, nor have I ever experienced anything... that primal ever since. And it was...
Well, you're also 18. Yeah. Everything is primal. Everything
absolutely.
Is life or death.
And it's the first time kind of thing. And
yeah.
and after all these years, like, you know, we got back in... Facebook got it. Like, I got back in touch with her. She still lives in town. She's married to the guy who was her boyfriend after me. And she's got like three adult
kids. He was in the next gondola over.
Yeah, exactly. And so she's, you know, so, and she's got kids. And it's nice because it was so distant that you start to wonder how much of it you made up mentally. Like, I'm like, was it really like that? Or do I just want it to be that way? And we had a brief like conversation about it at her place, like with the family around.
Does she know that she's in one of your panties?
Yeah, she does. Yeah.
Has she seen it?
Yeah, she has. Yeah. She is, but she's in the smiling one. There's a one where she's smiling. That's the one she's seen that one. She hasn't, and the one where she's crying doesn't really look like her that much.
Okay.
But, and the other one where who's crying, that's Suzon. That's not her. That's actually Manet's model who's crying. Mm. But it was nice because it was just one of those like this really happened, right? Like you were in this. You felt the same way. She's like, yeah. Yeah, she goes, and it was great, and it was a million years ago, but yeah, that really happened. I'm like, that's all I wanted to know, was did it really happen? So, in a sense, I'm reaching back to that, to, like, adolescent emotion, child, the things that, you know, were the things that fired me to draw in the very first place when I was a little kid. And at the same time, I don't want to either infantilize it or make it all about that. I also want it to be about contemporary things, like the things that only came to me as an adult, like a knowledge of contemporary art and art history, right, which didn't really come to me until I was in my 40s, really. So it's this mix and match of like childhood, adolescence, like, you know, middle age, you know, and the things that now I cherish and value in the visual lexicon kind of thing, and kind of mixing all that stuff together. But yeah.
You mentioned when you and I spoke prior at some point that you have had a number of difficult studio visits or, encounters, people encountering your work. Yeah. And I'm bringing that up because I'm interested in getting to the transition from being a cartoonist to being an artist. And I'm guessing some of those things coincided, right?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, there was a moment that really kind of, I went to Art Center. I teach at Art Center. I've been teaching there for 15 years. And they asked me to teach there after I'd only been out of school for like a year. Like, bless you, Wendy Adest.
That's
and Fred
nice.
Failau and all those people. But I went there as an undergraduate and then...
Which makes sense, actually, as a place that a cartoonist would go.
Yeah,
right?
Because they have a real strong illustration background. And all the kids I teach are really into, like, you know, anime and manga and stuff like that. So...
You show them some of your political cartoons, and
although I do draw, I do draw cartoons for them, but like on the spot, I can draw like Snoopy and Charlie Brown like I could when I was 5 years old. It's creepy. It's like hardwired now.
Yeah.
But one of my first classes was I don't know if you know Pauline Stella Sanchez.
I know who she is.
You know Pauline?
She went to UCLA a long
time ago,
she
was
big, right?
Yeah, UCLA, and she used to... I don't know if she still shows at Rosamond's, but she did, and she's like hardcore, like, you know, really brilliant conceptual artist, and was one of the most intelligent teachers I ever had there. She basically introduced me to all that post-structural discourse that was then, like, a key component of your education. And I remember, it was like my first class with her, and it was a studio class, and I was drawing something or other, and I remember she goes, "So, are you a cartoonist?" And she just meant it in a kind of neutral way, and I took it as an insult, because I'm like, no.
Sure.
Like, I'm in art school. Like, that's beneath me now. Forget this high-low mediation. It's like, no, I'm more like Gerhard Richter. I'm not Charlie Schultz, you know, kind of thing. Well, I think that one comment from her, like, got me away from representational imagery for about 15 years.
Wow.
Because I was really intimidated by it. I'm like, oh my God, like, am I a cartoonist? I don't want to be, that's not what I want to be. I want to be an artist with a capital A kind of thing. And so that was, you know, and Pauline, I don't blame her for that, but that was how I reacted.
You were too young at the time to actually sort of have a follow-up conversation with her about it.
No, I wasn't. I wasn't.
That's all the information I need. I'm just going to run with it, right?
It was a purely emotional reaction. I'm like, oh God, I don't want people to think that. You know, I don't want to be that. I need to learn how to be, I want to be like Robert Smithson. You know?
Well, and do you think you were already there a little bit in the decision to go to Art Center, to go to art school?
That was a big, the person who put me on the track for that was a childhood friend from Sacramento named Matthew Brown. He used to show with Michael Cohn. And I was working in like a day job, you know, trying and cold calling with my slides all over town for years and years. And of course, everyone's throwing them away. I didn't know any better. And Matthew, this childhood friend who... I was the kid who could draw. I was the cartoonist all my life. Matthew was just another kid that rode around on mini bikes and liked to go fishing. Okay. All of a sudden, I get an invitation from him, and he's got a show. And actually, then he was showing with Kim Light when Kim's space was on La Brea. And I go to this show, and there are these amazingly beautiful, he was working in balsam and oil, like this weird thing. And they were these crazy paintings. They were Disneyland, but they were distorted images. And they were stunningly beautiful. And he has this great show at this great gallery. And I'm like, this is what I want to do. Like, how come he gets to do? You know, it's like, what, I'm obviously missing out on something. So we met up and we got together, and he was the one, he says, you know, if you really are serious about this, you're going to have to stop doing what you're doing, and you got to go back to school full time. And at this point, I'm like 35. And I'm like, man, I'm like married, you know, I got a job, I don't want to go back to school. And he goes, that's the deal. He goes, I don't make the rules, this is how it is. You go back to school or forget it. He goes, or, you know, just paint and have fun. But if you want to do this for real and make this a life choice, this is what you have to do. And I'm like, okay. And so I did.
What was his thinking in giving you that advice?
He was just, I think his thinking was just, he's like, how serious are you? I'm like, really serious. He goes, this is what you need to do. He goes, and even that's no guarantee.
Yeah.
But you've got to go back to school. You can't just cold call your slides around at Bergamot
Station. Because you need to meet the people that will look at your work.
And you need to learn. Like, I thought I knew a lot about both art history, pre-modernism, and post-modernism. I thought I knew. I didn't know anything about it until I went back to Art Center. It was just like...
Was there a shortage of art history at your initial Art Center
education? Yeah. Well, no, not at Art Center. Like, when I was at Stanford, I took a bunch of art history courses, but I took whatever I wanted.
Right.
You know, I'm just like, oh, I think I'll take that Velazquez course, or I'll take that course in Greek.
Oh, so art, did Art Center come then after that?
Right.
Oh, I see.
Right.
So
yeah, Art Center.
35.
Yeah, Art Center came much later. Yeah. I graduated when I was, you know, 21, and it was like 15 years later I go back to Art Center. Got so it. All of a sudden.
And were you in that 15 years when you were, you know, day jobs and cold calling and all the rest of it? Were you going to openings and kind of looking at what was out there at the same time, or were you sort of doing your thing and then...
I was kind of doing that, but not really, because I didn't know where to go.
Right.
Like, it was like a closed... If you weren't knowledgeable about this world that we are in now, it can be kind of a closed out system. Like, people don't know, like, is this a legit gallery, or or they think a gallery in, no offense, Laguna Beach, you know, like plein air painting, like it's the same thing.
Right.
People don't understand that there's a difference, that there's these parallel art worlds and all this stuff. And so I did not know. It was just pure ignorance. I would go out to openings, but I didn't really know what I was doing or what was contemporary practice and what was interesting and what was going on.
You didn't have the map to sort of navigate.
None.
And also, you know, if you're talking 16 years ago, you know, Los Angeles was a very different place in terms of accessibility for, you know, galleries in the art world and different kinds of...
It was much smaller, much smaller. There was no Culver City. Yeah. There was no Bergamot Station. It was that long ago. Like, none of that stuff was around. And, Art Center was the pivotal...
Did your friend recommend Art Center? Or was that just where you wound up?
I was trying everywhere. You know, I was like, he actually recommended UCLA for all the right reasons. UCLA, and I applied everywhere. I applied UCLA and Art Center and CalArts, Claremont. I was applying everywhere for an MFA. And the thing, because I just figured I had a BA from Stanford, like, isn't that good enough? And of course, we all know that's not. I didn't know that. So I'm applying for a master's, and everybody's turning me down. I'm like, what is going on? And Art Center came back and said, we don't think you're ready for a graduate level. And they were right.
Yeah.
Like, if you looked at my portfolio, it would be embarrassing. But they're like, you're not ready for graduate level instruction, but we think you could benefit from a second bachelor's degree. And at that point, I was so desperate. I was desperate to change my life and do this. I'm like, if you throw me a bone, I'm gonna grab it. It's like, let's see if if I don't do this, like, I'll never get out of this life. Like, I'll never be the person that I think I could possibly be.
So, and you were with your wife at the time?
Yeah.
What was her take on all this?
She was supportive at first, but it is very difficult to It's one thing when your husband has a day job and things are pretty good and you got the house in Culver City. Deb and I, Deb lives right near where I used to live with my wife
in
Culver City. And it's one thing to live with the guy who's got a pretty decent job and you're living a pretty decent life and he paints on the weekends and isn't that great. And it's another thing when suddenly he quits his job completely and it's clear pretty early on that there's no guarantee of any... This is not like I'm going back to get a law degree.
Right.
Like, there's no guarantee that I will ever be financially stable ever again.
Right.
And the bloom comes off the rose pretty quick at that point. And there were other issues, you know, in any relationship. There were other things going on, too. But that was definitely... And I knew it going in. I'm like, this could cost me my marriage. But if I don't do it, it's going
to
cost
me... But on the other hand, obviously, to put the biggest cliche of all time out there, if she wasn't going to support you in this, fuck her, right?
Yeah. Gotta go.
It wasn't going to be the thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I have to do this. Or,
yeah. Well, know. And so dealing with this major, you know, all of the different impacts, not just quitting the job, but also
getting divorced my senior year. That's fun.
Well, yeah. And also, you know, what was it like to enter into the BFA program at 35?
It was funny. I still remember the first day of orientation. I was sitting next to an 18-year-old girl with greasy hair and bobby pins in her hair, smoking American Spirits. And who is still a very good friend. She is a great artist, and she teaches in Houston now. But I remember that day. I'm like, what the fuck am I doing here? Like, I'm here with like teenage, chain smoking punk rockers. Like, what? I mean,
this is the BFA program.
Yeah, yeah. Because they're mostly kids. You know, they were all pretty young. And the first day I drove home in tears, like after the first full day of school, which was ironic because the class that first day is now the class I teach.
That first day,
I was like, what am I doing here? Like, what have I done?
You have the perfect vessel, or what's the word I'm looking for? You are the perfect nugget of wisdom for the students that are coming to you now, having been through all this.
I like to think so, in the sense that it's
so
really...
So you don't say, so, you're a cartoonist, eh?
Of course, right? I would never say
that.
Yeah, exactly. And the same thing is true in that... It's funny because they're like, yeah, but you... They have a very romantic, simplified view of it. They're like, oh, so you left... You know, you gave this up so you could be happy. And there was a great Miles Davis quote about that. And someone says, oh, just like making the trumpet. Don't you feel happy when you play the trumpet? And he's like, happy. He says, I don't feel happy. I play the trumpet, man. That's what I do. You know, it's like, and it's the same thing. It's like happy. I wouldn't say happy, more like content and set. Like, this is what I should be doing.
Right.
This is what I should have been doing all along, and better now than never. Because that's what I try to tell the kids. I'm like, you guys get one shot at this. Like, this is it. You know, there's no do-overs when you're 80 years old and you're like looking back on, you don't get to come back and try it again. So you better like dig it. And I'm here to help you as your teacher, you know, pursue that. But yeah, like sometimes you do have to.
And yet sort of starting on that path at 35 is also a great argument for the possibility of constant reinvention.
Yeah, it's harder.
Yeah.
Because, Frank, you know, you're not young and sexy. You're not coming out of an MFA program and you're 25 and you've got a whole, you know, career, which is why I have to hand it to my gallery for, you know, representing me. I'm not the, you know, hot new flavor. You know, it's like, they're not like, oh, we'll get, you know, 40 years of work out of him. It's like, oh, he's coming into the game a little bit late. And so I'm very grateful for that opportunity, too, because it's harder. It's a lot harder when you're older.
Well, speaking of coming into the game late, do you want to maybe revisit some of those studio visits
absolutely.
Gave such great previews of?
Yeah, they fall into, there's two categories. Just to do it chronologically, the first category were the two most withering critiques I ever got while I was a student. And as most students will tell you, those are the ones that change you forever. They deeply wound you. I was in tears both times. But they transform everything.
Right.
And the first one, and I, these guys I'll name. I won't name the other people, but the, Tim Ebner, who's a now he makes these fish sculptures, and he just
he was for people who aren't familiar with his work, he was sort of a hard edge epoxy or, or enamel on wood sort of abstractionist, and more, and then he at some point midway through his career transitioned into flora and fauna, you know, animals
bears
and whatnot, and his recent show, which I didn't see, but was these stuffed animal fishes kind of on these poles,
right,
just to give people a little context.
Yeah, I mean, like he, like Tim's reinvented himself a couple of times, and I was in his class, and I'll condense it because it's a long story, but basically there was me and another woman, and she was painting like these horses. And it was stupid. I mean, it was real. It was like junior high shit. You know?
Right.
It was like really horses. Really, you're gonna pay a girl painting horses? It's like, you know, like a boy painting race cars. How stupid is that, right?
I think you forgot the horn, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I'm painting something, you know, that I think I'm painting what I think I should be painting in art school,
right.
Which is what.
It was kind of back to, it was political. It was about, like, I was interested in I was interested in the idea of comparative, like, religions and ideologies. I'd started reading more philosophy and aesthetics and post-structural stuff. And I was basically making paintings that were about what, you know, Derrida and Saussure and stuff like that, which you have to go through, you know, when you're a student. So she's painting horses. I'm painting, like, Derridian BS. And
sounds
Tim
like a
comes
good
over,
combination.
And Tim comes over and he goes, and Tim says, he goes, "How's it going?" And I'm like, yeah, it wasn't going well. And he goes, "I can see that." And I go, "Yeah, what do you think?" And he goes, you're painting this subject matter. He goes, "You don't really care about this, do you?" And I was like, flabbergasted, like nobody had ever talked to me that way before.
Yeah.
Even Pauline with her quote about cartoons. And I'm like, "What?" And he goes, "This thing about the religion thing," he goes, "like, you don't care about this. This is just like an idea. You're like illustrating an idea of something you find intellectually compelling." I'm like, "Huh?" I'm like not getting my head around it. He goes, "See that woman over there? She loves horses. And she's working on that painting as if her life depended on it. You don't think it's a very good painting. And you know what? It's not. She's not terribly good with color. She needs a lot of technical problems. But she's painting those horses, and that's important to her. So if you're going to come to my class, for God's sakes..."
She's no Susan Rothenberg.
Yeah, no, she's
right?
Exactly. But she really cared. And he goes, "If you're going to be in my class, for God's sakes, paint something you fucking care about." And he walks away. And I was just like,
"Damn!"
And I have never, and every day, I don't literally think of that quote. But that's, it's like, paint. What do I care about? And
right.
And sometimes it's easy to get sidetracked. And it only took a couple of years before I graduated. And Fred Failau, who is now the provost of the Art Center College of Design, was then just a mere instructor in the fine art department. I'm gesturing even when I'm talking,
I like
and
gestures,
I know nobody
yeah.
can see. Deb and I are both gestural talkers. But Fred, it was a senior seminar, and I'm giving a proposal that has diagrams. And at this point, I'm like a Robert Smithson acolyte. And everything's about land art and spaceships. I'm using like satellites and spaceships and the International Space Station, the space shuttle, to come up with some giant land art thing that's going to be in the desert. And
right.
If I only had the money, I could make this thing. And I'm presenting this thing to Fred. It takes me like 10 minutes. And I stop and go, "That's it." And Fred just sits there and doesn't look at me. He looks just to my left for like 60 seconds, which isn't long, but you just...
Feels like an hour.
It seemed like an eternity.
Yeah.
And he just sits there. And finally, he like gets my eyes and he goes, "And this should interest me because..." And I'm like... And another one, and I'm like, he's absolutely right. I'm like conflating. It's like you're getting off track. And I always think of both Tim and Fred that way because they got me. It wounded me deeply.
Yeah.
I mean, like, and you asked about this before. It's like, how did you recover? It's like emotionally, I didn't, But I realized pretty quickly on that they are 100% right. And I got to like snap out of this weird whatever space I'm in and get back to, you know, basics. Like what do I care about?
Yeah.
What do I love to draw? It's like, I love mayonnaise nudes. I like naked girls. I still love race cars. I follow automobile racing pretty closely. I still love
some
space
of your recent
stuff.
Paintings feature race cars.
I still love that stuff. It's like, it's not like it was a childhood thing that I left behind. It's like, I still really love that stuff. So I always try to be like, stay focused. Paint. And Tom Nechtel, another great painter and a wonderful instructor at Art Center, who shows with Mark Selwyn. But and Tom said, whenever you're in doubt, I never said that, Cole. But he said, whenever you're in doubt, like you're like kind of losing your way, he goes, follow the pleasure principle. Mm-hmm. He goes, it's kind of an easy answer. He goes, but what do you like? What do you love? What do you care about? What do you want to do? And that can just be subject matter or a way of working. It's like, I love painting. That's what I love.
Right.
You know, it's like, I don't want to make digital art. I don't want to make sculpture. I want to make paintings.
Well, and that's a gift, right? Because it's so easy to get caught up in several layers of remove from why you're there in the first place when you're constantly exposed to any number of different ideas of what's going on.
In this century, it's like the glut of images, it's overwhelming. It's like it makes, you know, being a painter difficult and being a teacher difficult because you're dealing with processing all this imagery and trying to like edit out what's important to you, that works for you, that's unique to you, and helping students find the same thing. You know,
I was wondering, going back to your studio stories, your school stories, mm-hmm. being an experienced teacher yourself, in retrospect, would you say that their kind of tough love approach is ultimately was the best thing for you? Or I imagine that you would have a lot sort of more empathetic bedside manners with your students, and I imagine over the years, in fact, I think I have a sense anecdotally that over the years, that's kind of more the way it was, whereas now teachers are a lot more diplomatic in their criticisms, correct?
I think that you would be correct. And I've always been, if I am critical of myself as an instructor, is that I think that I'm too nice to them. I empathize with them more.
Right.
Even though there's a substantial age difference, I was where they were not that long ago, and I know how hard it is, and I'm sometimes a little too sympathetic. I also, you have to remember, I'm teaching more like a foundation level course. It's not that elevated a discourse. It's more like about basic like composition and color theory and stuff like that. But like the first time I dealt with graduate level students, I did a seminar up at Fresno State with Sam Fields, who was kind enough to put me together with her group of people up there for their summer arts program. And I got to work with David Pagel, which was really fun. And like, we got to tag team these critiques. And the very first person I critiqued was a woman, and I made her cry. My very first student. I was way to go, big guy.
Huh? What did you say?
Her work was about extraordinarily personal issues, and we had to talk about it. And it was it really just had to do with the subject matter, and my encouraging her to confront it in a more direct way. I totally sympathize with her because she was dealing with such raw emotional stuff that you can't get right at it. Sometimes, like, she was trying to end around it to gently ease herself into that position, and I was trying to be like, you know, you really can't do that. You have to be more aggressive and confront these demons. And
so you weren't necessarily I don't know. I don't know that's mean. It's actually kind of really supportive. It's just difficult.
She was glad to have that feedback, and she told me in hindsight, and I'm glad to. And we're friends, and everything's cool. But I just remember going, oh my God, I just like. Really, again, my fear is like, I really hurt this person, you know, by, you know, bringing that up. And so you're right. As an I'm not the cruel taskmaster teacher model. I can't do it.
Right.
I just don't know how. I'll do it if I think it's important for the work, but I can't be mean or I can't. I just don't know how to do that. Or I couldn't. It would make me uncomfortable to do that.
I imagine, Deb, that you would never use that approach with your artists, right? Or for people who aren't your artists yet.
It's a, you know, it's a difficult It's a difficult balance to find, right? Because so much of what you've been talking about is the power of somebody makes a comment and it can shut you down or send you in a totally different direction. And sometimes a negative comment is exactly what you need, but it also depends on the person, because if you walk into somebody's studio and don't feel like what you're seeing is exactly the right articulation, sometimes what you need to say is this doesn't seem like the right direction. But sometimes that's also shutting down the half of what you see, or the three quarters, or the one quarter of what you see that might actually be the kernel of something that is fantastic. Mm-hmm. So navigating that can be a thing. But there are also consequences to being too diplomatic and overly kind, which is some of my artists, if I walk into the studio and I don't say something good about a particular thing, think that that's, you know, the kiss of death, or, you know, they're looking for more subtlety in my reactions. And sometimes it's actually kinder to be extraordinarily straightforward.
Yeah, so I just imagine that in your position, that would be a difficult thing, because basically you realize that when you're going in to do, like, what everybody wants, whether they really say it or not, is everybody wants you to come in and go, holy heck,
right,
this is the greatest work you've ever made,
right,
and I'm going to bump everybody out of the way so we can give you a
right.
show in 2 months. You know, everybody wants to hear the superlatives, whether they're deserved or not.
Which,
and so that must be difficult for you.
Yeah, which I don't do unless I mean it. But I definitely had, you know, it depends on the artist. I've definitely had one of my artists say, I don't completely trust you because you don't tell me what you don't like. And I took her over to her website and pulled things up. And I said, I don't like that one, and I don't like that one, and I don't like this. And you know, I mean, if somebody asks, I'm always going to give them,
mm-hmm. Did you
know,
then have to explain
honest.
Yourself for a while?
No, she's pretty hardcore. It was good. It was good. She was just like, oh, good, yeah, I trust you now.
Yeah.
That's the
yeah,
thing.
I've gotten tough love from my guys, and it's again, it's super painful when it happens, but it usually
what
is.
Guys?
Cliff and Aaron at Western Project.
Oh, okay.
I've had and it's a good point you bring up, Deb, is that the whole thing is when they do a studio visit, you know, my trust level's really high because they've come in and they have done
right.
the, oh my God, these are so great, you know, and they've also come in and, I mean, lowered the boom in like 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And so I know it's, there's this line in, what is it, Outlaw Josie Wales, where Clint Eastwood's talking to the chief, and they're about to fight, and he's like, you know, now you know that I come here with my guns because my word of death is true, but I come here with the promise that I will live with you because you know my word of life is true. So you know the word of death and the word of life are true, so I trust
right.
them, because I know it's like they're not blowing smoke up my ass, you know, if they like something, and they're very specific.
Right.
It's like, this is what is working, or this is what, you know, is not working. The feedback is really helpful. And to segue into like studio visits, I've had three with a curator, a gallerist, and an A-list LA painter, none of whom I shall name. And all of them took, and these were like the weird studio visit where they come, and instead of getting that kind
right.
of feedback, positive, negative, or some kind of conversation, this happened to me three times. And actually, they were all before I started showing with Western Projects, so these are distant, but they're amusing because they were all the same. Different people, artist, curator, gallerist.
Right.
And big artists, too. I was like, I can't believe this person's like looking at my work. And they come in, all three of them, and the work's there, and we have a conversation the way we're having a conversation, only the work is never discussed.
Right.
At all. It's never even acknowledged that it's hanging on the wall.
Oh, that's
and
awkward.
And sometimes the conversations actually are pretty, they're about the art world, and they're about,
right.
you know, or personal things. How are you doing? How's the family? You know, how's the gallery? What's your next show? And, you know, and you're just like, you obviously don't, you know, I'd rather you just say, you know, dude, this stuff sucks.
Get the fuck
happened,
out of here.
Yeah, but that happened three times, and it was weird. It was just it was so diplomatic, but it
yeah.
was like
right.
like it wasn't even acknowledged that the work was there.
Yeah, I don't know that that's actually diplomatic though, because if you completely ignore it, that's just
painful.
Yeah,
it's
I mean
painful.
I think that for me, if I go into a room and I know that it's not my personal thing. There's still always something you can talk about. There's still always questions you can ask. Yeah. There's still always a way of engaging with what's in front of you. And if you're doing those jobs, you know, you're ostensibly are interested in having conversations with artists, yeah. you know, and kind of knowing. And you, there's always something, yeah. you know, you can.
But so, yes. so what I want to know, Cole, is at how far into these visits did you start thinking to yourself, all right, I got to ask them.
Yeah.
What do you think of the work? Are you going to say anything?
They're never going to bring it up.
Because at some point you're saying that in your head.
Yeah, it was pretty early on in all three instances. It was very apparent that this wasn't going to happen. And if that's not going to happen, I'm not going to force it. If like that's the general feeling, let's just let it ride and have a nice day.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's you're right. It's like it's an indirect way of saying something very directly. It's like, wow, I am really not interested in what you're working on, and I don't even know where to start talking about why I'm not interested in it. So let's just, you know, let it go and, you know, walk away from it.
Dude, if that ever happens again, I think you should force it. I think you should just start talking about it and just be like, you know what? I want to see whether or not you guys actually engage because this is your fucking job.
Yeah. And, no, and you know what?
Yeah.
yeah. And again, I want to
especially the curator. I mean, there's no excuse there.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It was, and it would, I want to stress that this was fortunately, these were like a while ago. I haven't
had these names up on the website shortly.
Everything that's happened recently, whether it's my gallery or friends or curators or artists, has always been very straightforward.
Yeah.
It's like everybody's, you know, pretty open.
Well, and it becomes much easier to filter out those kind of things, and you assume that people who are coming to the studio are, you know, they have enough interest that they actually want to engage, which is kind of a good thing. Have you... I was wondering in the sense of being somebody who's doing work that is representational, and I know we're kind of not talking about work, but representational and...
illustrative.
You know, I think about you saying that thing about having, you know, at least two of the major early commentary that affected you being about doing what you love. Does that... you know, help you keep your compass in a time when sometimes representational work is much more challenged by the art world?
Yes, yes. I mean, it doesn't make the job any easier. But it's what I love to do. It's how I think I am making work that is of who I am in a very direct kind of way. And I joke with friends of mine who are abstract painters, and who I have many, and I am like, you guys, my hat's off to you. I don't know how you guys do it. Like, I really don't. It's like that's the hardest job in the world. It's like, mine is difficult.
Eric Fischel says that too.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know how they do it. It's like, I mean, it's a loaded history, and you have to deal with how do you make an abstract painting?
Representational is pretty loaded too.
It is. And that's difficult also. And like, how do I choose? Like, how do I manipulate the content so it's not a rehash of what somebody else did? How do I refer to Manet without just copying Manet?
Right.
I mean, you know, where to use text is always an issue for me because I'm like, I don't want it to be about writing, but there's always stuff that you're worried about how to edit or how to handle, and what do you look at art history to make happen. But it is really hard, but I love doing it, and it sounds stubborn, but like, this is what I do. Like, it's like, I'm not an abstract painter. I tried being one, and I wasn't terribly good at it, and it's very difficult. And as soon as I started working once more with figurative and representational imagery and landscapes, I'm just like, this is what you do, and this is what you love to do. And you do it in a way, or I like to think, it's like, it doesn't look like how anyone else does it. And you're manipulating things in a different way. But it is hard because it is criticized for being illustrative and referring to pop culture and all those things. And I'm like, you know, I like race cars and spaceships. I like Star Trek, so sue me. You know, it's like, but there's reasons why those things are important. I mean, they sound silly and trite, But going back to the beginning, you know, I had a pretty profound experience when I was a little boy with 2001 and Apollo landing on the moon. I mean, that stays with you like forever.
Yeah.
You know, and the race car thing, like, you know, that's a very strong tie-in with my father, like going to like automobile races with him. It's a very powerful emotional thing with me in terms of family and personal history. So right. It's like it's stupid ass race cars. It's like, you know, it's like, yeah, it's a race car. That's my dad. You
yeah.
know, it's a very.
Oh, okay. You know. So you're gonna go metaphor. I was gonna ask you what kind of race car you drive, but
there,
I guess they're stand-ins for people.
In a way of looking at it, all the paintings are self-portraits, really, whether right. I'm in them or not. But I do want to clarify that people in America, everyone thinks if you say you like car racing, they think NASCAR, and I don't like NASCAR at all. I like Formula One, the 24 Hours of Le Mans, and I like IndyCar racing, which are very different. So just those of you who come up to me and say, I really love NASCAR, don't say that. But,
yeah, all the NASCAR listeners of this
yeah.
podcast.
Exactly. Yeah,
Jesus
exactly.
Christ.
Yeah. Yeah. It could be a serious subcurrent.
But again, it's
you
like
just don't know is there.
But
yet,
once I get a NASCAR
no, it's going to
gonna
happen.
I've crossed over.
It's going to happen in the comments.
But
right
you
now.
Bring up a
you're
really good
out.
Point in the sense that it's like you try to stay true to the compass.
Right.
And it's easy to stay true to the compass, but I'm not making these just for me. It's
right.
like you need to look at them, and Michael, you need to. And, you know, the public and the critics and the collectors and my gallery needs to look at it. And, like, just because I like it doesn't make it a compelling image or an interesting image. It's
right.
like, how do I take those things and make them unique or have different relationships and make them something that's more open-ended? It's like, I'm telling you, like, the skeleton key. It's like, this means this. Yeah, there's metaphor. This means this, and this is why, you know, my high school girlfriend is important to be in this. But that's not what I want you... To, you know, that's why I try not to talk about the content too much, because I want you to look at it and have a totally different experience, and or somewhat different, so that you're looking at it and you have a different set of associations or generate different relationships or come up with some different experience than me.
Right.
Because I don't want to tell you what to see, you know, or what. But at the same time, I do have to work with my vocabulary.
Right.
And that's the hard part, is how do I make that vocabulary not so personal that it distances any viewer
right.
from enjoying or participating in the painting somehow. And that's the hard part. It is, especially when you're dealing with representational imagery, because people are like, oh yeah, that. You know, it's a recognizable
yeah.
thing.
And memory, and growing up someplace where things are iconic. I mean, I remember the first time I realized that Sunset Boulevard was, this is going to sound totally embarrassing in all kinds of different levels, but the first time I realized that Sunset Boulevard was a thing that people outside of Los Angeles knew about. You know what I mean? Kind of the recognition that some of the things that are your memories are in fact owned in this universal way. And how do you kind of interact with that? And
very true.
Yeah.
That, we were talking earlier about the what is known as the cemetery painting, which is the painting of Hollywood Forever.
Yeah.
And that was one of the most difficult aspects of working on that was... The point of view of the painting means the Hollywood sign is in the painting.
Right.
And I need to be really careful how I paint it so that to delete it, to edit out the sign, is a lie. Because
right.
it's there. But that, even though that's where we live,
right.
it's an icon to the rest of the world. So how do I, as a painter, technically, like, minimize it so I'm not eliminating it, but I'm not drawing your attention to it? Like, you have to kind of look at it for a while before it's there. You have to be really careful, because someone else is going to bring a whole different read.
So it sounds like you had to be faithful to your representation.
Yes. But at the same time, careful. Like, really careful how I present that.
I think that is a perfect sentence to end on, because I think we were faithful, and I think
Indeed.
We were careful. Deb, well done.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So nice
Thank
to
you
be
both.
Here, you guys.
Thank you, Cole.
Thoroughly
Cole
enjoyed
case.
It. That's
Thanks,
great.
Cole.
All right,
and
guys.
We're out.
We're out.
We're out. Thanks, guys. If you like what you've heard on the Conversation Podcast, please feel free to donate. Any contributions are welcome at theconversationpod.com. You can also become a fan of the show on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter. And you can also support the show by going to iTunes and leaving a nice review about the content that you've heard on the air tonight.
Hey, I'm with him. And he said it, not me, by the way. No, seriously, Thank you very much for listening, first of all. I hope you enjoyed that as much as we did. Support has been light for the show of late, so if you do care to support the show financially or otherwise, it's much appreciated. Spread the word. You know, you can do that via iTunes, as he mentioned, or simply word of mouth on Facebook and in person, God forbid. All right, I appreciate that in advance. Thank you for being here, and I will look forward to speaking with you in the near future.